Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the limit to presidential powers. Yesterday, the Supreme Court rejected President Trump's claims of absolute immunity. In two major rulings, the court stated that both Congress and criminal prosecutors can seek a president's tax returns and other financial information as part of their investigations. But for those who hoped the court might force the president to disclose his tax returns before the November election, the decisions did not go far enough. David Korn is Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones. He's been among those calling for the release of Trump's taxes for years. He joins me to talk about the Supreme Court's decisions and what's next. David Korn, yesterday in a 7-2 ruling, the Supreme Court essentially said the president is not above the law. What were the specific questions they were dealing with?
Well, they were dealing with a set of subpoenas. There are two different sets, really. One from a series of congressional committees that were doing various investigations into Trump that involved his finances, and they were asking for financial records from banks and from his accounting firm. And the other was Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance Jr., who had a very specific, as far as we know, specific criminal investigation into those hush money payments that Trump and the Trump Organization made to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal before the election. Stormy Daniels being the porn star who alleged to have had an extramarital affair with Donald Trump, and Karen McDougal, a Playboy model who said the same thing. This is what landed Michael Cohen in jail. He paid these women money so they wouldn't come forward with their stories. It was a hush money payment. Trump was implicated in the scheme in legal papers that were filed in the case, but he wasn't indicted himself. But there seems to be a continuing investigation to whether those payments violated tax laws or other business laws in New York State. And so Cyrus Vance has gone to Trump's accounting firm to get financial records, including income tax returns for Donald Trump, in pursuing that criminal case.
Now, what we hear from the Supreme Court through those rulings, that ruling is that the president is not above the law.
Exactly. The way I like to think of this is the president lost legally, but he won logistically. And I'll explain that. On the legal side, his team had argued that he was above the law. I mean, that's literally what they said, that even if he committed murder while in office, he could not be prosecuted or investigated. And that when it came to congressional oversight, that he could basically defy it. If Congress asked for records, he could just say, get lost. And basically, he was arguing for absolute immunity, categorical immunity from any investigation or prosecution from any source. This is unprecedented. No president has ever, claimed this. And when there have been cases in the past involving the Watergate tapes with Richard Nixon, or whether Bill Clinton could be sued by Paula Jones for sexual harassment, the court had said quite specifically, you're not above the law. And so it wasn't a big surprise in some ways that the court came back 7-2 with two conservative justices who Trump had appointed himself saying, you are not above the law. You can't say, just get out of here. I have a get out of jail free card from any investigation while I am in office. But each decision came with a big but. And that was that these cases should go back to the lower courts, which have ruled against Trump, for further deliberation on the specifics of these requests. So in the case of the criminal investigation in New York City, Trump is now free to make other arguments, more specific arguments to the particulars of these subpoenas to try to stop them. And Cy Vance, of course, can claim that he needs his information. and pursue it. And on the congressional committee case, basically Roberts said it should go back to the lower courts, and there should be a more scrutiny of whether these records are necessary, whether they're overly broad, whether they're tied to legislative intent. And so in some ways, and I don't think this was purposeful, in some ways, Trump's legal strategy had a touch of brilliance to it, in that it seems unlikely now that any of these cases will lead to these records being produced, or at least becoming public, before the election. So they went in with an argument that was in some ways ridiculous, and it was tossed out by 7 out of the 9 justices. But it took up a lot of time, and it, you know, kicked the can down the road, and now it goes back to the lower courts, and from there, maybe we'll go back to the Supreme Court, although they could, you know, refuse to take it again. But it makes it very hard for this material to see the light of day before the election.
Now, that's what I want to ask you about. Is it possible that there will be leaks of that tax information prior to the election?
Well, remember, there are two streams here, right? There's Cyrus Vance and the congressional committees. On the Cyrus Vance case, he can go back to court essentially today and say, okay, let's get these, you know, let's get these subpoenas honored. The banks, Deutsche Bank and Mazars accounting firm, have said we will comply with the court order. And so he can go back to the court right away, and maybe that will move faster. And the court will say, okay, we say it's a good subpoena, turn the material over. It could go up to the Supreme Court. They could just say, we're not going to take the case. And maybe he can get that information. But that information is pursuant to a grand jury investigation, a criminal investigation. And when you're a prosecutor getting grand jury information, it's supposed to remain confidential. It only becomes public if you decide to indict someone and include it in the indictment, or you go to trial and you use it as evidence. If you don't use it in these public venues, it stays secretive. It stays confidential. Now, of course, it could be leaked if it ends up in the Manhattan DA's office, but you know, prosecutors tend to take grand jury confidentiality quite serious. And while there have been leaks in the past, they're not common. Now, you look at the congressional committees, and we all know Congress leaks, you know, like a shipwreck, right? So the fear from the president's side would have to be if Congress got anything, even if they say they would treat it confidentially, they don't have the same rules and it would leak. There are members of the committee, there are lots of staffers, and it also could leak from the side. The people who are handing it over might say, well, if Congress has it, we can leak it now to the New York Times or Mother Jones or whoever. But that track seems to be on a slower pace. You know, House committees can go to courts, but now they have to prove, you know, meet certain standards, which of course Trump will argue against. And there could be several rounds of that information, of that further legal dispute, and might be unlikely that it's resolved anytime before the election.
So it was an important decision with regard to executive power that may not have much to do with the upcoming election.
Exactly. It was a slap in the face to Donald Trump, who basically said, I am king. I mean, his people, his lawyers actually argued that he could not be prosecuted for murder if he went down to Fifth Avenue, as he once said, and shot someone until he left office. He could not be prosecuted. So the courts kind of laughed him out of that argument. He left him out of the courtroom. But so in terms of precedent, it's a solid precedent for the rule of law and for the balance of power. But in practical terms, you know, they still protect him from releasing material that he seems determined to keep, you know, secret.
And that's what I want to ask you about. A lot of people, especially Trump himself, seem to think that making his tax returns public would be a disaster for him. So remind us of some of the financial crimes of which he's accused?
Well, let's take a step back. Every president since Nixon has released his tax returns, every presidential candidate, including Hillary Clinton. Joe Biden did it last summer. Elizabeth Warren did it in the primaries. Every candidate has done this. The Bushes, he's the first one in modern times to say he won't. But at first he said he would. I mean, before he ran, and even I think as early 2016, he was saying, we're working on it, we're getting it together. Then when it seemed he was actually close to becoming the nominee, he totally flipped. And he said, we're not going to do it. I'm under audit. And there's nothing that says you can't release them when you're under audit. Every president's tax returns get automatically audited, and they still get released. Barack Obama released all his tax returns while they were being audited. So, and these audits seem to be going on for years and years and years. You know, are his 2014, 2015, 2016 tax returns still under audit? People I talk to, tax experts, say no. It's highly, highly unlikely. And he has produced no evidence, no letters from his accountants or from the IRS saying that he's still under audit. So he decided at some point in time that it was just he could not survive releasing his tax returns. That they would show something about him. Maybe he wasn't worth as much. Maybe the fact that he was worth a lot but gave no money to charity. Maybe that he used tax dodges that are a little sketchy that if other people looked at might find some criminal or at least improper activity. So he decided not to do that. And, tax returns don't show everything. Think about your own tax returns. They don't necessarily show all your wealth. They won't necessarily show all the debts he has. His business has literally hundreds of LLCs, limited liability corporations, and we don't know what a lot of them do. They don't file individual taxes that are open to the public. He has some debts that he's reported that make no sense, that have suggested to some experts that he engaged in fraud amounting to millions of dollars. Tax returns might give us a few more pieces of information about that, but he has been adamant about this. And the subpoenas, to bring it back to the Supreme Court cases, asked for more than tax returns. They asked for financial records held by his accounting firm and by his banks, including Deutsche Bank, that lent him hundreds of millions of dollars, that might indicate, even give us a better picture of what he's done financially.
But really, in fact, is any of this information, should it come out, going to change any minds of his supporters who believe he's being attacked unfairly?
Yeah, it's unlikely. I'm not the only one. Norm Ornstein and others have said that his supporters have behaved like a cult, in that they take whatever he says at complete 100% face value. It is a small, a third of of America, whatever it might be. They seem unpersuadable, even. In the middle of the COVID pandemic, they still, think he's doing everything right, and they are following his lead and not wearing masks, which is, in some ways, deplorable. So it's unlikely that information would come out that would change their mind. I did talk to a political consultant, a year or two back, who said that one thing that might come out of this that might change some people, and we're talking about, on the margins, is if the tax returns showed that he really wasn't as wealthy as he claimed to be. If he was kind of fraudulent in his persona, that might change people. We've seen, the New York Times did an amazing piece in October 2018 that his family had engaged in fraud. They called it fraud to get out of paying hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. It seemed to be illegal. We've seen some tax returns, portions of tax records from Trump that indicate that he's used practices that seem to be sleazy and dodging and avoiding taxes. Michael Cohen testified that in some instances he inflated assets, in other instances he deflated the same assets and engaged in fraud in terms of getting bank loans and perhaps in paying his taxes. So, if this stuff came out fully, it might persuade a few people on the fence. But I don't think there are many people in America on that fence any longer.
Yeah.
But in a close, narrow election, you know, we saw what happened in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. In a close, narrow election, anything of that nature could hurt Trump and his reelection prospects.
So, David, for our listeners who follow you on Twitter, do you intend to keep reminding us that today would be a good day for Donald Trump to release his tax returns?
One of my colleagues at Mother Jones told me yesterday that I had tweeted this 675 times. I don't keep track. I don't do it on weekends. Every once in a while, I forget, but I have been doing this since the beginning of the Trump administration. And yesterday, my family was asking me, okay, are you going to still do this now that this case is somewhat resolved? And I kind of said, in a penny, in a pound. And I woke up this morning, it just felt like the right thing to do. So I think I'm going to do this until Election Day. And the reason I do this is because, to me, this was the most basic norm in American politics that Trump violated. It was not a rule. It wasn't a law. It wasn't a guideline set by anyone. We just decided as a country, this is how our politicians should behave. And it's a reminder that not everything is governed by laws, right? Some of it is just governed by agreements. Even when parties are at each other's throats, we still have some sense of norms about how we should still behave, even if it's a big mud wrestling partisan battle. And so by ignoring this norm, which is basic to having a government not run by conflicts of interest, Trump really, I think, set the tone for his presidency. So it's a reminder, I like to think, maybe this is, you know, my conceit, that it's a reminder of something much bigger than just one set of documents. So with that in mind, I think I'm in it for the long haul, at least until Election Day.
More from David Corn when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with journalist David Corn. Now, I want to turn to Mary Trump's book about her dysfunctional family, and in particular, she thanks you in her acknowledgments. Tell us why.
Well, I was very surprised by this, I have to say. I'm at the top of the list on the acknowledgments, and it says, thank you, David Corn, for your kindness. And that's really all it says. And as soon as the book came out, I started getting calls from reporters, from friends, from colleagues, from people, and just who I don't know, but people on Twitter, you know, wondering why I was thanked so prominently. And I've written the story about it. It came out in Mother Jones on the website this week. So if you want the full version, they can go to that. But in short, in the last weeks of the 2016 campaign, I was looking at a variety of stories about Donald Trump that had not gotten sufficient attention. One was the Russian story, and I was working that, but another one was a lawsuit involving his family when his father, Fred Trump, had died. Basically, the children of Fred Jr., Freddie is what they called him, who had died at the age of 42 years earlier, were cut out or given a very small piece of the estate. And they accused Donald Trump and his siblings of basically fraudulently kicking them out of the will. And it led to lawsuits and acrimony. And in the course of that, Donald Trump and his and other siblings cut off medical insurance for the family of Freddie Trump's son. And he had a kid who was in the hospital, had a terrible disease, and it just seemed very mean And it was, you know, it was a very tragic story. And Mary Trump was part of this lawsuit as the daughter of Fred Jr. And I saw, like, there was nothing in public, you know, media accounts about Trump's background, about Mary, and very little about this lawsuit. And I kind of said, wow, she'd be an interesting person to talk to. I wanted some databases. I found a phone number for her in Long Island. I saw she was a registered Democrat. That made it seem interesting to reach her. And I called her. And, you know, this is a week or so before the election. And she got back to me. And she said she couldn't talk on the record. You know, she had signed an NDA as part of the settlement of the lawsuit. And there seemed to be, she worried about the financial implications of Trump attacking her brother and her brother's family and taking money away from them when they still needed it for medical issues. But she was heartbroken about what was happening. She knew Donald Trump. She thought he was a broken person, a damaged person, psychologically unfit and dangerous to be president. And she was basically in a state. And we had a series of phone calls where I listened to her and I was empathetic. I'm a journalist. I tried to give her, I presented the case for talking and going public. And she, you know, had her reasons not to. But we kept talking, even though it was all off the record. And she was grateful that I was giving her time, even though I wasn't able to write about it. And then, you know, Trump won and she was even more miserable and upset and talked about what she could do to fight the forces of Trumpism. And at the end of the day, and she writes about this in the book, I mean, I think she was paralyzed for a couple of years, didn't know what to do. I didn't get the story out of her. Every couple of, you know, months or once or twice or three times a year, I would just send her a note and check in with her. And then it turned out that she did help the New York Times do that big tax story that came out in the fall of 2018. She got some records out of the lawsuit that were essential for the story. So she did help them. But she did that quietly. No one knew. I suspected she was involved. Sent her a note and she goes, "It's quite a story, isn't it?" And she didn't tell me anything. And then in May, I was thinking about her again and how she must be feeling watching what Trump was doing during the pandemic. And I reached out to her. And this time I didn't hear back, nothing at all. And then a few weeks later, it was announced the book was coming out. I wrote a note. I said, "Oh, now I understand why I didn't hear back from you." So anyway, I've talked to people near her, close to her, because she's not allowed to talk to the media now. She's under a temporary restraining order that's being worked out in the courts because she's being accused of violating her NDA that she signed with Donald Trump and the family. And they, you know, say that she was very grateful and appreciative that I listened and I was there. And even though she couldn't cooperate and, you know, work with me on a story, you know, it mattered to her. I don't think, looking back, that it was for me, it wasn't a big deal. But I guess that, you know, you never know when an act of kindness at a particular moment in time will mean a great deal to somebody else.
Absolutely.
Right. And so as I wrote in my story, I never got the scoop, but being publicly cited for being kind is not a bad consolation prize.
You bet. There is one revelation. I mean, there are so many revelations according to what I've read thus far, but one: who took Donald Trump's SATs? Do you think we're ever really going to know?
Well, Mary writes that he had a friend of his take the SAT test, and I believe she provides the name, or a name has come out. Unless someone comes forward, I think, and says, "Yes, I did this for Donald Trump," 60 years ago, whatever it might have been, 50 years ago, we may have a hard time resolving it. It is, of course, compared to everything that we've seen publicly about Donald Trump, a minor blip on the list of wrongdoing or, you know, sleazy things he's done over the years. But it's interesting because he has always called for the school records of Barack Obama and the people who believe that everything that Donald Trump does is an act of projection. Got another piece of evidence when this story came out and they went back and looked at all the times he's called for Barack Obama to release his college records.
So I want to ask you also about a piece in this morning's New York Times by Tammy Duckworth about the attacks on her made by Tucker Carlson. And I just wanted to get your take on that.
Well, I hate having takes that are obvious. It's like, it's outrageous. I mean, any decent person, I don't understand how any decent person can look at someone who, you know, volunteered to go into the army, served in Iraq, had her legs blown off, came back from that, became a senator, and call that person a coward. Call that person, you know, you can disagree with them. You can say they're wrong. I don't like their policy. I think you're supporting the wrong thing, you know, but to call that person a coward, I mean, it's a good indication of what's happened on the Trump conservative side, in which enemies are demonized. You can't have an honest disagreement. You know, if you do something Trump doesn't like, you're low IQ. If you're a woman, you're fat, you're ugly, you're a dog. It's pretty despicable. And, you know, I knew Tucker years ago. I did a few shows with him on CNN. And, he was a conservative. I'm not. We disagreed. But I always thought he was someone you could have an honest policy debate with. I thought sometimes he was overly clever and try to, duck certain issues as a conservative because he liked to be seen as cool and cosmopolitan. But nevertheless, I would not think that he would question my motives, question me, my character, and we would stick to the facts. The whole Trump years themselves have raised a question for me about how people like Tucker, or even Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, people who I disagree with, but who seem to have some, sense of ideology, principles, once upon a time, have just become attack dogs and part of this Praetorian Guard or state TV for Donald Trump. I don't understand truly what's in it for them. I don't understand how they don't think that history will look back at Donald Trump as a guy who didn't do much, while 200,000 Americans or more died during a pandemic, and anyone who supported him is going to be tarred with that brush. But nevertheless, so Tucker's out there not arguing facts and not zeroing in on the main issues of the day, the pandemic and economic inequality and racial inequality, and trying to create this alternative reality for Fox News viewers. It's a cliche to say, how do you sleep at night? He can get by without the money. He could do this show without being this way. So these are proactive choices that he's making. And having known Tucker, having worked with Tucker, I'm at a loss for an explanation. I don't get it.
David, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
All I would say is that I know everybody is going through a lot these days. It's a stressful time. It's an anxious time. Trying to think about what to do with kids if your kids are school age is, I think, is torturous. I there are no good answers. I feel like the Trump approach is, you are on your own. We will not give you good information. We will not do everything we can to tamp this pandemic down so we could even consider sending kids back to school. You're kind of on your own. Even when it comes to wearing a mask, imagine this, Diane. If someone told you, you could take a simple act, a very simple act, and save thousands of lives, and that would be wear a mask and tell people to wear a mask and add that you should socially distance. And that's all you had to do. And that would save thousands, maybe tens of thousands of Americans' lives. And you don't do it. So I think looking at the leadership we have now, it can make people really angry, fill you with despair, stress, and anxiety. And I just hope, and I think we are, I think we're, as a country and as a people, we are strong enough to do this and get through this. It's harder than it would be because of Trump and the leaders we have in office now, or the non-leaders. But I'm hoping everybody can just stay engaged in this marathon and get through the next few months, next 6 months, maybe in the next year, for us to get back to a good place. I know it's really, really hard, and I struggle with it every day. But I'm hoping that, you know, together, people of good faith and goodwill, even who have differences on policy matters and other things, can still pull together and in some ways save this country.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to talk to you.
That was David Korn. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, analyst for MSNBC, and co-author with Michael Isikoff of Russian Roulette. That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. And please remember to wear your mask. I'm Diane Reed.